Welcome to Courage Cocktail. I'm your host, Leanne McClymont. Thanks for tuning in, and I am glad you are here with us today on this chilly day in North Carolina, January 2013. As you get settled in, I'll be serving up a warm brew of Courage Cocktail. I'd like you to settle in and imagine yourself being surrounded by some beautiful camellia trees and the birds that make them their home. Tune into this. This sound is taken from the Camellia Festival that happens every year in Northwest Florida. This particular soundtrack was recorded in January of 2010. Here's the backstory to today's program. On January 16th, a wonderful article was published in the New York Times by Anne Raver from Swarthmore, Pennsylvania. In this article, all my Northeast friends buzzed me through emails and posts with interest and questions about camellias. I, quite coincidentally, published a picture on Facebook of the very camellia tree blooming by the mudroom in our house. Yes, you see, the mudroom serves as both a washer-dryer area, and the dryer vents right out on the tree. Can you see where I'm going with this? The cold snap that brought us the flowers, but it was the wet clothes that preserved them. I was soon on a mission to learn more about camellias and learn about these with the express intent of persuading my friends in colder climates to be brave enough to plant them, or a species at least of them that would be winter hardy to Zone 6. Within days, I was sitting among some new friends at what I learned was the world's premier commercial camellia forest nursery. I spoke to the owner, Dave Parks, and the chief person in charge of propagating new stock, Miss Bree Arthur. Now, before we lead into that conversation, I'm going to give you some helpful tips so that you don't get lost, as I did when I was thinking about the taxonomy of plants. You all remember in high school that wonderful mnemonic, keep pots clean or family gets sick. You got it, kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species. Pay attention to the last three steps here, family, genus, species, as you start pondering, planting, and selecting your own camellias. Take a listen to this conversation and take a deep dive into the wonderful world of camellia. Welcome to Courage Cocktail. I'm your host, Leanne McClymont. We are sitting in what we would call the head house, but I think it's heated, and the nurseries of the Camellia Forest Gardens. And I'm sitting with Dave Parks and also the lovely Bree Arthur. Thank you for joining us today at Courage Cocktail.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dave, I'm going to ask you, you've inherited this type of business. Your mom and dad started this business. Can you tell me what it's like growing up surrounded by beauty of camellia?
I took it for granted. Where I grew up, my dad planted thousands of camellias. There were maybe about 4 acres of camellias, all his seedlings.
Yes.
And so they were always there. So I just thought that was normal.
Was there ever a time in your life when you were separated from the camellia?
Yeah, when I went to college and in graduate school, I was aware of plants, but I wasn't pursuing that.
When you come back here and you see how much it's grown, and that today, listeners, it is cold in North Carolina. We agreed that it's about 36 degrees Fahrenheit, and we're outside of the Chapel Hill region. So this is a little cooler than we're used to. But when you come back and see on a day like this the blue sky and the flowering camellias, it's pretty stunning. Now, Bree, I have a lot to ask you. When you think about all the things that you've done and you're working here, I believe you're in charge of propagation. Or tell us about your work here at the Camellia Forest.
I'm really fortunate that I have my ideal job. I get to do all the propagating and all the growing and also all the organizing. So it combines my strong OCD tendency. And I feel very fortunate that I get to really express my organizational skills to the degree that I get to. But I have a fabulous time. In the spring, I go around to different gardens throughout the Southeast and gather anything that is remotely interesting that maybe we haven't grown before and propagate it and hopefully have it available for customers, you know, the following season so that we always have fresh new material that keeps our customers coming back.
Now tell me a little bit about that fresh new material. Do you introduce each year some new selections?
It's my goal to have at least 50 new non-camellias in the catalog because, you know, those are plants that are often not available anywhere else in the U.S. And our customers tend to be more of the plant nerd world. And they want these rare, obscure things that, you know, have a fasciated stem or an odd variegation pattern or, you know, just something that you won't find in a box store. And it's really fantastic that we get to have this outlet. We can provide these interesting plants that, you know, may only be in one garden. And I get to propagate 40 or 50 and suddenly they're in 50 other gardens. And
when you think about what led you here, tell me, how did you make your way to the Camellia Forest?
I've worked in a lot of facets of this industry, so I feel like my happiness here is well-educated in from what I don't want to do, and I'm really fortunate that David kind of created a position for me to come and propagate and take some of the load off of him. But I, you know, I've started in floriculture production for Walmart, and went to state gardening and worked in the wholesale trade and the perennial production trade and the landscape design industry. And this is certainly fits my personality in that I get really excited about these weirdo plants. And there aren't a lot of nurseries that can actually stay in business growing the plants that we grow. And it's just such a perfect opportunity to be able to do the production on a scale that I can handle. And you know, offer these things to people that, you know, they might not ever see again in the industry.
So let's spend half of our time talking about the camellia, the whole family of camellia. And one of the reasons that we got so much attention on this particular Facebook, we always pre-post and advertise what's coming up ahead, is that the Northeast was very interested in seeing if they, in their cold winter temperatures, could ever, ever grow camellia, which we know is just does beautifully in southern cultures, but maybe not so up in the Northeast.
Well, actually, David could probably expand on this. It's because of cold snaps that we get occasionally in the Southeast that kind of led Camellia Forest on the path of developing cold hardy camellias.
My dad has been breeding camellias since the early 60s. And a lot of his seedlings were planted around our house.
Which was in North Carolina.
Yeah. He was actually looking at cold hardiness as a criteria. But we never, for the first 20 years, we never got cold enough to actually really injure most camellias. It just wasn't cold enough. The flower, he was looking at flower bud hardiness. Mm-hmm. But then in 1985, we had this winter where the temperature dropped to -9 Fahrenheit, which broke the record by 9 degrees. The all-time record, and most camellias and a lot of ornamental plants in the landscape were killed to the ground. That spring, things were just black. It was really depressing. But in his test plot, which was just lots of camellias planted in his pine woods. Some plants did not die back to the ground. Some plants still had green leaves. And of these plants, he selected some that had nice flowers and were good plants that have turned out to be dependable in colder areas. So it's basically extending the area where camellias can be grown.
Extending it into the colder regions. So that kind of unfortunate cold snap in 1985 revealed the genetics and the specific traits of a cultivar that was worthy of being propagated and could withstand that kind of temperature
right.
and that zone. And from there, he went ahead to craft a family or a collection or varieties, I guess, at this stage, that would be able to be propagated and endure or survive colder climates.
In fact, Survivor, which is aptly named, was selected from that bunch.
Yeah, well, it was in this group where it was the only one that was still green. Everything else was brown all the way to the ground. I mean, most of the camellias, they all came back from the roots. So now you couldn't tell that everything was killed to the ground.
Which reminds me something. Even though something looks dead on the outside, the roots may not have froze. Is that right?
Right.
A vibrant core.
Yeah.
Is that what it's called? A vibrant core?
Yeah. A lot of cases, these shrubs or not so much trees, but ornamental shrubs often, you know, you can cut them to the ground and they'll come back. Or they can freeze and it kills the top part, but the part that's in the ground will sprout back.
So now when you look back, that was 1985. In 2015, that would be almost 30 years ago, so it's 28 years ago. So you look over this 30-year window and you consider what's gone on and how much your father, as Dr. Clifford Parks,
right.
worked to promote the camellia among the Americans and beyond. Maybe, Bree, you could tell us who buys these camellias. Are they just us regional people?
No, not at all. One of our biggest markets does seem to be in the northern regions, you know, up through New York and certainly along the East Coast, because we have this large collection of Zone 6 camellias available. We also have a huge market on the West Coast, and we always laugh that so many people that live in Chapel Hill don't know about us, but we have this following, you know, 3,000 miles away. I think Dr. Clifford Parks and Dr. Ackerman both, you know, work diligently to expand the region where camellias can be, because I think, you know, even 50 years ago, camellias were really kind of a Gulf Coast, Deep South tradition, and they're important for those regions. I think a lot of people often think camellias are actually native to the U.S., even though it's within their botanical name. They aren't. They're Asian natives. But, you know, they've thrived through the Southeast, and it's a great opportunity for people to take a piece of the Southeast into, you know, a more northern climate.
And I do know what you're saying when people just assume they're a native to North America, but they're not.
A lot of the southern sort of heritage plants, you have hydrangeas and camellias and hollies and azaleas, and actually all of those plants tend to be native to Japan or China or, you know, some region of Asia. But we have a very similar climate, so they do extremely well here.
Can you explain to us the history? One little bird just didn't drop all these seeds.
Absolutely not. This was actually, the camellias were certainly part of, you know, the trade that goes along with slavery and tea and China and
sure.
Plants have been, you know, moving around the world with humans, well, for as long as people have been moving across the oceans. And I think originally camellias were introduced to the U.S. for the ornamental purpose, but tea is a fabulous reason to grow it for more than just the aesthetic.
All right. And listeners, we're going there right now. One of the things that's flying out of this nursery is your tea plants. So let's talk about what is a camellia and what is a tea plant, and are they the same thing?
No, they're not the same. We've got...
They're the same genera.
Yeah, if you
different
start...
Different species.
There's genera Camellia, which yes. is a group of plants that have similar traits. So there's and then there's maybe 100 or 150 different species.
Yes.
And that's in a different, smaller category. And one species is Camellia sinensis. And that is the plant that's used to make the tea we grow. The rest are a bunch of different things. They grow from Vietnam, mostly in China, Japan, Korea. Some of those are ornamental, and the Camellia japonica, Camellia sasanqua, are the main ones that are grown as ornamentals. You can't take the leaves from the ornamental ones and treat them like tea and make a beverage that's worth drinking. For some reason, the Camellia sinensis, the tea plant, has lots of compounds which give it fragrance and has caffeine, and it's just kind of unique.
So, Bree, maybe you can fill in the blanks for our listeners. So, specifically, there's this particular species of the generic Camellia called Camellia sinensis, and that's where we get tea?
That's where you get tea. And all the variants within that species make the same kind of tea. It's how you handle the leaves post-harvest to determine whether you get black tea or green tea or white tea. And then you can add, you know, herbs and dried flowers to make flavored tea. But yes, tea is Camellia sinensis.
What happens when you grow a plant called Camellia sinensis? How do we harvest it? How do you make those segregations of these kinds of teas? I always thought it derived from different plants, but indeed not.
Most people definitely are fascinated by this process. Speaking of the variants within the species, small leaf tea, which is Camellia sinensis variety sinensis, shows the most hardiness, and that's right now labeled for Zone 6A. And so that's really opened the doors to people, you know, up the East Coast, certainly into New York, to be able to grow a tea plant. The main difference is the size of the leaf and the rate in which it grows. We grow a variety that's just labeled as Camellia sinensis, quote, large leaf tea. But it's a tetraploid. So it means it has double chromosomes. So the leaves are larger, they're thicker, it grows extremely fast. As we were talking earlier, if you have a small yard, perhaps large leaf tea isn't the right choice. This is going to be more difficult to manage in a small form versus the small leaf tea, which is, I'd say, going to be about half the size. I think you could probably manage small leaf tea closer to 4x4. Versus 10 by 10.
So now we're saying you can scale these tea plants, these Camellia sinensis, to this real estate that you've got. But how do you go ahead then and harvest them? What do you do? Shake all the leaves off?
If it was that easy. You're actually harvesting the new growth. So you're certainly not harvesting at this time of year. Mm. Generally for us, it starts
about end of March, depending on the weather.
And you're harvesting the top two leaves and the bud. So it's a very small amount of material. It's quite laborious to gather tea, especially if you drink many pots a day. You would need a good plantation to support your habit. But it does give some perspective on the tea plantations throughout the world and the labor pool that goes into supply tea for the American grocery stores.
But once you harvest the tips of fresh new growth, you allow that to dry, kind of let it wilt.
Yeah.
Usually about a day. And then you can manipulate it without the leaves crumbling. So after it's wilted, you can manipulate it, like roll it in your hands, or there's various ways of you're kind of breaking up some of the cells to release some of the compounds in the leaves. And after that, once you've bruised it, you would dry it in a fairly, moderate temperature, like a 250-degree oven, so that you've heated it up so that it's no more biological activity is going to happen. And that would be green tea. But if you wanted oolong tea, you would bruise it and then let it sit again for a period of time. Then once it's sat for however long.
Are we talking months or days?
Hours.
Hours. That's the margin of error.
Yeah, and then you would do the drying process.
Sure, again. In 250-degree Fahrenheit oven.
The Chinese traditional way is in a pan, in a wok, and they stir it but with their hands.
Okay, to make sure it doesn't get too hot for fingertips. Yeah, yeah. Makes sense to me.
And then black tea is processed more. So you bruise it, and then you let it sit often in a big kind of in piles. And that you get a different flavor.
These teas all have different flavors. And one of the things that I would think that if you were controlling your own harvest, you could control what happened to that leaf, what happened to that plant, what you fed that plant.
How you grow it organically?
Oh, absolutely. How it integrated into the soils that you have, the water you're drinking, it's drinking. So does that influence the taste of the tea?
Well, there's no comparing the tea that David's wife Christine makes to what you can find commercially.
Really?
It's so much fresher. It has a different, more full-bodied flavor. Whereas the bag tea is often just kind of like warm cardboard. It's a good medium for adding, you know, honey or sugar, or, you know, something to warm you up, but it's not delicious and tasty. The fresh tea that Christine makes is just, you know, incomparable.
Now, do you sell tea here yet?
Yeah, we have samples.
And the only reason I would imagine is that there are a lot of skeptics. And I'm, of course, a skeptic. I have to be as a reporter. But you're telling me that I have to go ahead, plant this Camellia sinensis, and harvest it with great care. Go ahead and produce these leaves, bruise them, wait a little while, throw them into a 250-degree something, and you're going to tell me it's all worth it.
It is. I mean, it's a lifestyle choice, and I think there's a lot of people that do enjoy the self-sufficiency.
Yeah.
Whether you're doing it for a daily consumption or if it's just something that's special, I think there's a real romantic concept tied to it. When you're growing it, you've tended to it, you know, it's something that makes you more aware of the universe.
And it's also off the grid.
Absolutely. Most people have no idea that you can grow tea. Most people don't even know that tea necessarily comes from a plant. And to think that camellias are in every grocery store in America is just fascinating.
Little known facts about what lurks on those shelves. So now, I'm curious when you consider the kinds of popularity. You and I, we took a walk, Dave. We walked through the gardens. We got some natural sounds. And in that process, Bree explained to me that people, this younger generation, are very sensitive to not only what things look like, but also what purpose they serve. Can you develop that with me, Bree?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the tea is a unique situation because it's also a really beautiful landscape plant. Whether you're harvesting from it or not, you can enjoy it aesthetically. And then it boasts one other huge advantage. It tends to start blooming in August when a lot of other plants aren't blooming, and it's a wonderful source for pollen for honeybees. So you have this other crossover with people that are really trying to preserve the honeybee population. Tea fills a time of the year when there aren't a lot of other plants producing pollen. So I see tea as being this kind of complex plant that's attractive, especially to the new generation who maybe doesn't have the luxury of having acres of land to have a big garden. They can grow this one plant and it serves many functions.
So that reminds me, even though we talked about a few species, small leaf tea and large leaf tea, are any of these comfortable enough to put into a container and sit in your patio out in San Francisco?
Or? We grow them all in containers.
You do?
Absolutely. You know, the thing with container culture, you just have to keep up with making sure that they don't dry out and that you bump them up as they grow and, you know, give them enough soil space and keep them fertile. But there's no reason that you can't grow plants in general in containers. That's how nurseries produce them.
There's this prejudice, I think, in our mind's eye, or certainly in my mind's eye, that, oh, is that plant connected to Mother Earth? You know, you have this plastic or clay pot in between its root system and Earth. Is this just crazy?
Well, Sometimes it is, actually, because there are some plants that you simply can't grow well in the ground. I'm thinking specifically of the fabulous Daphne. And everybody loves the winter-blooming Daphne, sure. And yet it's very sensitive to root issues. It's much easier to grow in a pot where you control the water and you know that it's draining well. And I think that you can take that concept and apply it to all plants.
Yes.
And if you only have a patio, that shouldn't make you not grow plants. You just have to grow them in a different way. And there's nothing wrong with container gardening, and especially container gardening with shrubs, because it gives you something to look at year-round. You're not just planting, petunias for the summertime. It gives you something to look at year-round.
When you think about all that you've done and are going in the world of camellia and the interest of teas and organic and sustainability, take out your crystal balls for me and tell me, what do you think is in the future for camellia? What are you hoping for?
Well, I'm hoping that everybody in America has a tea plant in their yard at some point.
Yes.
Because you know what? There is nothing wrong with sitting down at 4 o'clock and having a cup of tea and reflecting on how nice your day has been and enjoying the little things. I think that's what growing plants can provide. It gives you this outlet to have something that makes you happy in an intrinsic way. That's beyond the news of what's happening in the world. It's kind of private and protected, and it's something that should be cherished, and I think everybody would be happy and well-adjusted if they grew more plants.
Spoken as a true plant nerd.
Yeah. Everything revolves around plants.
People, they can get in the way, but the plants...
Tell them, go tend to your garden. Don't worry about it.
But, we do see this urbanization. We see more and more of our populations, not only in the U.S., but clearly everywhere in the world. You see that in China, a tremendous influx of humans moving into the city. Why? More jobs, a higher quality of life, higher access to health and education. We see this in the U.S., of course. So this plants and container stuff may be the most important axis, almost AXIS, the point around which we can organize and fulfill that need to be connected to the ground without necessarily being as blessed as we are here in North Carolina.
Well, that's true. And the technology with rooftop gardening and vertical gardening has really expanded what you can do in urban areas. And I think every place on the earth is enhanced with plants from an aesthetic point of view, from a sound barrier, from an environmental perspective. And urban areas should not be devoid of living material. They should actually be filled more because there is a bigger population there. And I think especially as a new generation comes, they're going to see that from an agricultural perspective, it doesn't necessarily make sense, and that you should be growing more food locally with your environment. I mean, maybe you don't need to have spinach in July. You should maybe be eating tomatoes at that season. And, I think that there's a lot of potential on the edibles front. I'm really excited about it. I think that the U.S. suburbs could be a huge ag hub if they were just designed and planted to feed people instead of having sheared holly hedges.
Absolutely. We were up recently in our last episode. We studied prodigal farms and their goat keeping and goat milk cheese making, and it was a delicious.
Your products
day.
Are wonderful.
Oh, I know. Shout out to the gals, to Dave and Dave Krabby, of course, and also Kat Span. But what we learned about that is how much space we waste. We don't approach our space in urban or suburban context with the idea of how can we use this to produce food. I suspect as time marches forward, that might be a hallmark of the newer generation. The kids coming in saying we need to be in the city, but we want to
eat
local.
Fresh, local, organic food that's nutrient rich and, something. It's sad that that's a throwback concept, but everything should not come from box.
Yeah. Well, I am so grateful that you were able to share what you do, why you do it, and how beautifully you do it with our listeners here. Thank you for being with us on Courage Cocktail.
Thank you for having us.
I can't wait to come back. When is the big open house here?
Open house begins on Friday, February 22nd. We'll be open Friday and Saturday from 9 to 5.
Okay. That's a month away, kids. That's right. That means get your social calendars booked. Come on out to Camellia Forest Nursery.
And visit us on our website at camforest.com.
And that's www.camforest.com. Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you. Thank you both. I can't get...
As the conversation turned into heirloom plants, we wrapped up our new ways of thinking about the value of heirlooms. Our conversation also included this small tag. In it, the keen listener will get a deeper sense of the value of what it means to select carefully heirloom plants and where it might be the best place to invest your hard-earned sweat equity.
Its size, and it feels like a boutique that you're going into.
Large for a boutique. Well, maybe not as a big box store.
Exactly. And you're picking up heirlooms, and you're picking up items that you may not find anywhere else, or if you do find them, they're going to be in very small quantities.
So let's talk a little bit about this, and we just heard from...
I'm Keith Alexander.
Keith Alexander. He works here, too. And he's been joining us and listening quietly in the background. But as the conversation shifted away from Camellia and into the history of Camellia, Mrs. Bree, forgive me.
Oh, that's okay.
brought up an important concept. And tell us about what's changed in this whole corporatization of materials, plant life.
Well, you know, obviously there are people that have dedicated their lives to breeding plants, and the way for them to earn their income is to patent the new varieties, and then those varieties often get put into a large production scheme to go into box stores, which is where you're going to see the most revenue. But as a small collector's nursery, we can't compete on that level, and trying to figure out how do we stay current, how do we keep having the same customers come back? We can't offer the same plants over and over again.
We always have to have new, every year, we have to have new plants.
We have to have new, if nothing else, for our curiosities as well. If we weren't working here, we would be shopping here. I was a customer for years before I actually joined the team.
Okay.
So I thought, well, we've got these fabulous connections with other camellia enthusiasts throughout the Deep South, where they're growing plants that have been in the ground since the 1850s. They've survived hurricanes and droughts and fires and wars, and these plants are really sustainable. I mean, you have a 150-year-old camellia. It's a small tree. And they opened their garden at Magnolia Plantation for us to come and take cuttings of any of the plants that they had, and we were able to secure a nice collection of plants that are generally from the 1850s to the early 1900s that have been out of the nursery trade for a long time, if they've ever really been in the nursery trade. And they're fabulous plants. They're all Camellia japonica cultivars, and many of them have big, bodacious, Victorian-era style flowers because that's what they were breeding for back then. Big, variegated plants with, you know, flowers that look like peonies and formal doubles, and they're just glorious, and it's been a great expansion to the nursery. And actually there'll be an article in Heirloom Gardener about this new collection of heirloom or ancient camellias, as they're referred to.
Well, and it sounds to me as if you've also had the foresight to consider the true worth of sustainable. It's not sustainable in the 21st century. If it was sustainable in the 19th century, then you've got something worth preserving and stewarding into the 24th century.
Absolutely.
For all we know.
And I mean, as a camellia enthusiast, I think we all feel a responsibility to preserve these varieties that are kind of out of style from the nursery point of view, but certainly from a collector's point of view, they aren't. They're quite desirable. And I think it's really special here at this nursery that we can gather these collections and offer them to customers and get these plants that might only be in one garden into a whole bunch of gardens. So if that original plant dies, there's backups. The genes aren't lost.
The genes aren't lost. The history's not lost. But the culture that founded it to begin with is resurrected.
It's still here.
It's still here. There is no doubt.
Once you get addicted to camellias, there's no turning back.
Well, I am so grateful that you were able to share what you do, why you do it, and how beautifully you do it with our listeners here. Thank you for being with us on Courage Cocktail.
Thank you for having us.
I can't wait to come back. When is the big open house here?
Open house begins on Friday, February 22nd. We'll be open Friday and Saturday from 9 to 5.
Okay. That's a month away.
Right.
That means get your social calendars booked. Come on out to Camellia Forest Nursery.
And visit us on our website at camforest.com.
And that's www.camforest.com.
How I hope you enjoyed listening into that little tag of a conversation. It often happens during the course of these visits that the most meaningful comments come in at the end. We were listening to the owner of Cam Forest Nurseries, and his name is Dave Parks. The nursery was started by his mother and father, Ty May, and his father, Dr. Clifford Parks. In addition to the voices, we heard Bree Arthur, and in the final tag, we listened to Keith Alexander. I want to thank my new friends over at the Camellia Forest Nursery and thank them for teaching us and showing us the future of where botany is going. When we come back, you are going to have a more in-depth lesson in everything you need to know about teas. Stay tuned.
Need to learn about meditation? How about Meditation 101, a free class Tuesdays at 7 p.m. at the Kosala Buddhist Center above Carburetos, 711 West Rosemary Street, Suite E, Carrboro, North Carolina, 27510. For more information, go to their website, www.meditationinchapelhill.org. Again, www.meditationinchapelhill.org.
Welcome back to Courage Cocktail. I'm your host, Leanne McClymont. Did you hear that tea kettle brewing in the background? We were broadcasting our program that was recorded on site at the Camellia Forest Nursery here in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Their website is www.camforest.com. They take online orders. It's a wonderful resource to learn about camellias and also to learn about the entire collection of plants that they have there. I always say to people interested in the region, what better way to visit Raleigh and Chapel Hill and Durham than going out to some gardens websites and see what the plant life is all about? Now, when I left that nursery, I promised to talk about a few additional things. One of them is to just shout out, there will be a big open house next month, February 22nd to the 24th, where the Camellia Gardens, the Camellia Forest Nursery will be open, as will Tony Avent's Plant Delights, which is based in Raleigh, and also a very special little farm called Pine Knot Farms in Clarksville, Virginia. Their specialty is hellebores. This is all planned for February 22nd to the 24th. I want you to take a look and consider coming and checking out these gardens. We have a rich variety of world-class horticulturalists who are building wonderful gardens, commercial gardens. They are very rarely open to the public, so you have to pay a little bit of attention to when they do have an open house and avail yourself of those opportunities. Now, the reason I played that tea kettle is to go through some of those lessons that we learned earlier this afternoon. The overview that I'm going to be reading from and extracting is something that the Camellia Forest Nursery people built. It's on their website, and it's all about tea gardens. It's to help you inspire the home grower into making your own tea so you can experience the fresh flavors and the pleasure of watching your own tea grow from garden to teacup. When you grow your tea, the Camellia sinensis will grow exactly where your ornamental camellias grow. They need a well-drained site. It's very important to avoid soggy soil. They'll need a half a day of sun or partial shade, which would be ideal. Improve the soil if it's needed, and by doing that, you add 3 to 5 inches of compost or soil conditioner. In heavy clay soils, which we all know North Carolina is famous for, you'll have to add some more compost over a wider area. Water is needed for the first year to get the roots established. A deep watering one or two times per week may be needed in the summer to keep the roots from drying out. You want to plant these tea plants in early fall or spring, and if you choose summer, it must be well watered. After planting, if a late frost is predicted, cover to protect the new growth. By the way, if desired, you may lightly fertilize in early spring with a low concentration of slow-releasing fertilizer. This is pruning for these tea plants, and you prune them in late fall and winter after the flowering, and this will promote spring growth. Tea plants should be kept to 4 feet. This will allow you to pick them. They can grow taller. Tea is naturally resistant to most pests, and rarely should any pesticides be used, especially on a plant that's harvested for tea that you plan to drink. By the way, tea plants can be grown indoors, but they prefer a cool winter temperature, which cool in our world is less than 60 degrees Fahrenheit. With a high light, which would be a south-facing window, they prefer humid environment, so should be kept outside most of the time. Bring inside your plant when it's getting cold outside to prevent frost damage for the leaves or freezing the roots. Now I'm going to teach you a little bit about harvesting tea. Should you be so brave as to plant your own sinensis, Camellia sinensis, your leaves can be picked as soon as they start to grow in the spring. And then you can pick continually throughout the growing season. That's April through October. How do you do this? Well, it's trickier than it looks. First, you have to pick one or two of the newly growing leaves at the leaf bud, which is right at the tip. Early in the season, try to leave a couple of new leaves on the growing stem. Leaves will always grow back and often branch. You can pick new growth at the same location, usually between 1 and 2 weeks. This is important, kids. Harvesting tea should be processed the day that you pick it. But your leaves of these tea plants can be left and spread out on a dish and allowed to wither for several hours to overnight. If they are very dusty, the leaves can be washed before withering and blotted gently to dry. Handle leaves carefully so they do not break or bruise at this stage. So now that you've got this mini little lesson in the selection of where you plant your tea plant and how you harvest those leaves, I want to go back and talk to you a little bit about how we make the difference between making tea. These tea qualities are very, very regionally and seasonally. There are many variations on how to process the leaves into 3 categories of teas: green tea, oolong tea, and black tea. Green tea is not oxidized at all. So that's why when we drink green tea, we have a grassy, vegetal, and earthy flavor. This is how you get green tea. Harvest the leaf bud, plus 1 or 2 of the youngest leaves. White teas sometimes use just the bud. Let them wither in shade or indoors until they're limp. To prevent oxidization, steam the leaves for 1 to 2 minutes on your stove, as you would a vegetable, or pan fry them in a skillet or wok for about 2 minutes. Hand roll the leaves, which not only achieves a desired look, but also allows flavors to infuse that hot water differently than the unshaped leaves. Spread the leaves on a baking sheet and dry in your oven at 200 to 250 degrees Fahrenheit for about 20 minutes until they're dry. You'll enjoy the smell of those drying leaves. You store the dry tea in an airtight container away from the light for about 3 or 12 months. Now, oolong tea is partially oxidized, and with that it imparts a floral or a fruity flavor to the tea. Pick up and wither. Follow the steps just as you do for green tea. You might pick slightly larger new leaves. Hand roll or bruise the leaves by shaking or pressing. Let sit in a cool but not dry environment until the leaves begin to turn brown, which is 30 minutes to about an hour. Tea can also be rolled into balls, which is optional, dried, and stored just like green tea. Now, black tea is made because it's fully oxidized, and this imparts a smooth, fruity flavor to the tea. Pick and wither just as you would for oolong tea. You may pick slightly larger new leaves. Firmly pack and hand roll and bruise the leaves, allowing all the juices to be released. Place in a layer in a cool environment until the leaves are completely brown. This may be hours to days, this process. Shape the teas and then dry and store them, just like you did for green and oolong. Now, we all may think we know how to brew tea, but I'm going to read through just the final few minutes here. You use 1 teaspoon of leaves per cup. Infuse in hot, which is less than boiling water, for green or white tea, and that's about 2 to 3 minutes. And nearly boiling water for oolong tea and blacks, which is 5 to 8 minutes. You can infuse the leaves with 2 or more tea times, but the tea that sits for too long may become bitter or astringent. To reduce the caffeine, discard the first infusion after 1 minute, and then go ahead and drink the second cup of tea. I know that we're out there and you're listening to the story about tea, but when we started to investigate the camellia farm, the camellia gardens in the forest, we realized that a large part of camellia and that industry is making tea. I had no idea the level of expertise that I would find among my friends over at the Camellia Forest Nursery. Now listen, I want you to consider checking out their website one more time. It's www.camforest.com. And then we're going to have a little bit of a wrap-up of what happened this past weekend when we returned to Prodigal Farms for our cheese-making class. Stay in and listen in. As you may remember, last week we visited with the owner, co-owner of Prodigal Farm. The reason we reported on that is they were planning a wonderful dinner. In fact, it happened last night, where we interviewed not only the owner of Prodigal Farm, but also the chef that was responsible for creating the menu. That's Katie Featherstone. And also the brewer, the master brewer, who was Eric Lars Myers. In the course of the weekend, Bill and I took a cheese-making class under the tutelage of Katie Spann over at Prodigal, and we had some amazing events. I queued up this little segment so that you would truly understand. We were surrounded on a piece of property about 300 acres big, and included on that were some very special and very friendly goats. The class was overwhelming. There were 12 of us, and neither Bill nor I were prepared to take a deep dive into the technical and historical and, dare I say, just the social side of making cheese. We did. We spent most of the day there learning all about aseptic techniques, the importance of raw milk, and the importance of understanding why we have to be particularly careful in processing these cheeses. Now, what bearing does this have to you, listener? Listeners, when you approach that cheese shop or any cheese, I have to tell you, this is a more involved process than it looks. And it's been an extraordinary opportunity for Bill and myself just to have a sense of how cheese is made. I'd like to suggest that you pay a visit up to Prodigal Farm on their website, www.prodigalfarm.com, and take a poke at some of those pictures she may have up there of this class. What we're seeing happen in this region is people's interest in learning more about the kinds of food that they put on their table and they put in their bodies. Cheese has been a staple in our diets. Knowing how to make cheese may be a vastly important experience and a store of knowledge that could be easily shared with future generations. I encourage you, wherever you may be, if your agricultural colleges or your communities of farmers offer a class in cheese making, whatever you do, take it. You don't necessarily need to run out there and make your own cheese. But I have to tell you, it gave me a profound sense of respect for all the work that cheesemakers across the country and throughout the world do to present those products and bring them to your table. We're very, very grateful for all of our listeners, and you all have been following me on Facebook. The Facebook page is just increasing. It's lifting its popularity. More and more people are downloading that page. I appreciate it, the podcast, and sending me your thoughts. We will post the pictures that I took, the complete collection of pictures that I took yesterday while visiting our friends at the Camellia Forest. And I also want you to think about you coming out to Stitcher Radio and also Twitter. The most important dates that you have in your calendar for the end of February, of course, is visiting their open house at the Camellia Forest Nurseries here in Chapel Hill. And at the same time, if you get a little time on that weekend, go ahead and visit Tony Avent's Plant Delights as well. I want to thank you for joining us on Courage Cocktail. I also need to thank my sponsor, the Triangle Swim School, over at the Triangle Aquatic Center in Cary, North Carolina. By the way, you can learn about their work at www.triangleswimschool.com. They have a wonderful Facebook page, too. If you're on Facebook, check them out. Our friend, Coach Matt, has been updating his Facebook page regularly with thoughtful ideas about teaching our children how to swim. It's not too late, and it's certainly not too early to learn how to swim either. I want to thank you for listening. I will be here next week when you bring the lunch and I'll bring the courage cocktail.
This is WCOMLP, Chapel Hill, Carrboro.